Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Do you know how to put just the right amount of effort into what you do in order to achieve the best possible results? If you have figured that out, you've discovered what my guest calls the sweet spot, and you're probably really enjoying your work, your leisure time, and your relationships. For the rest of us, though, the busyness of everyday life can make all those good things hard to appreciate or even to fully experience. My guest is here to share some counterintuitive lessons from science about what will keep us focused, productive, and present in our own lives. Sociologist Christine Carter is senior fellow at UC Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center. Her new book is called The Sweet Spot, How to Find Your Groove at Home and Work. Christine, welcome back to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you've built this career around studying what it takes to be personally happy and professionally successful, but you are candid here that in your own life you sometimes struggled to walk the talk. What made it tough for you?
Well, you know, I had a great life. I still have a great life. I had a great career and I was really happy with my family and I had it all, so to speak, but I was exhausted all the time. And I started about 5 years ago to really struggle from a health standpoint. I caught every virus on every airplane. I had strep throat for 18 months, nine courses of antibiotics. It was nothing that was actually very serious. It was just an indication that I truly wasn't walking the talk, that I was happy in many ways, but I still was working too hard. And the thing about it was that people kept saying to me, well, you're going to have to give something up. You're going to have to slow down. And everything was so hard won for me that that was the last thing I wanted to do. So this book was my road testing all the research that I had gotten so good at teaching other people, you know, applying it to my own life so that I wasn't overworking.
You think we need to stop confusing being busy with being important?
Yes, this is one of the greatest cultural lies of our time. You know, we associate busyness with significance, with success, and we assume the reverse is also true. If we aren't busy, then we must not be very impressive, very important, very significant. In fact, we might be underachieving. And in fact, there is no correlation between busyness and success or even productivity, which is really interesting. It's much busyness is much more related to what researchers would call cognitive overload. And cognitive overload is not something that we want. It makes us less creative, less intelligent. It's harder for us to control our emotions, to remember really important social information. You know, you name it, cognitive overload taxes our system in a way that hurts us and keeps us from fulfilling our potential.
So when we take on too many responsibilities, too many obligations, too many, you know, dates to do things, it sounds almost like multitasking at a macro scale.
It is. And the important thing for us to remember is that our human brains, as wonderful as they are, were not designed to multitask and they were not designed to run 24/7. So we assume that we are like computers, only better, and that we can just turn ourselves on and keep working in a focused way and even run multiple apps at the same time and assume that our system is going to work well. And in fact, that's not the way the human brain works.
So the idea is to find this sweet spot that you mentioned in your title. Tell us more about what that means and how you can know when you've actually hit on it.
Well, most people know when they've found their groove or they're living in the sweet spot. The sweet spot, to me, is that point of maximum impact, right? Where there is incredible power or your personal strengths are really coming through. But there's also, and this is the key part, incredible ease. There's a lack of stress or a lack of resistance. So I love the baseball metaphor, right? Where when you watch a baseball player in slow motion video hit from his or her sweet spot, you don't see any motion in the bat or in their arm or their shoulder in a way that indicates friction. But when they hit outside of the sweet spot, often the bat breaks or you see a ton of friction there. So keeping that in mind, you know, we know when we are living or working from the sweet spot, when there's that ease, but also incredible power.
So to take this metaphor, and I have to tell you, sports metaphors are not really my thing, but to take it further, if you, I mean, it's possible to sort of hit outside the sweet spot and, you know, hit that ball from a different part of the bat, but you have to work much harder to get the ball to the same place. Is that it?
Yeah. Yeah. And you can't really get the ball to the same place. It's funny that you say that because I'm not really much of a sports fan either. It's just that for this particular one, all the good metaphors are in sports. But it is. I like people to think about the fact you probably are getting hits in your everyday life. Especially the high achievers among us are getting hits, but it's very taxing for your body. It's damaging the bat. It's damaging your shoulder. That ball is not taking its most natural flight. You're not going to hit a grand slam outside of your sweet spot. You can get some hits, but there's not as much power. And over time, it will take its toll on you.
Turns out a big part of this is learning to accept what is good enough, which is not easy for people. But talk about the difference between maximizing and satisfying.
Oh, okay. Yes, I think that especially for recovering perfectionists like me, it's very hard to learn when good enough is actually good enough. So maximizing is something that is very easy to do in modern society because we have so much information coming at us all the time. So a maximizer is somebody who likes to gather lots of information and weigh all the different choices and all the different the different bits of data coming in before making a decision or moving forward on something. And a satisficer is somebody who is able to establish criteria for success and then stop when enough information has come in that meets their criteria. So to make this a little bit more concrete, well, I'll give an example in a second, but what I want to say is that the tendency to maximize is associated with lower productivity and also lower happiness. Happy people learn how to satisfice, and they tend to get more done and move more quickly through their projects, but also be more satisfied in the end. That's why it's called satisficing. So say you need to pick a location for a company retreat or you're trying to go on a vacation. A maximizer is going to look at lots and lots of different locations and cities and then lots and lots of hotels within that and gather lots and lots and lots of information about all the different sites before choosing something. And then once they go on that vacation or they go on that company retreat, they're likely to not feel as good about the choice that they made. So a satisficer says, okay, well, I know that for this vacation, I definitely want to do a sport. And in fact, that sport is skiing. And if I can find a place that won't exceed this budget, then That's the place that we'll go. So it's establishing what a success is and then sticking to just that criteria and stopping investigation when the criteria is met. So say the first city that they look at meets all the criteria and then the first hotel that they look at meets all the criteria. They stop. They just book it right then. They're done. And what happens, part of the way that the happiness is affected is that they're not looking at all the choices that they didn't make in the end. They go on their vacation or on their retreat. They get to ski. They're happy about it. They're not thinking, wow, I could have been in Hawaii doing yoga and regretting the decisions that we don't make. So that's just one of many brain booby traps that we have to be aware of, that if we spend a lot of time gathering information, all those choices are likely to make us feel dissatisfied in the end.
So how do you convert a maximizer into a satisficer?
Well, usually when I'm trying to do this, I have to convince people that satisficing is not about lowering your standards. You can set as high a standard as you want and set your criteria for success really high, but then commit yourself to stopping the information overload once you have the information that you need. Once the choice appears that meets all the criteria, you just have to commit yourself to going with that. And then making a focused effort to see the positive in the choice that you did make, looking for the reasons why it was the right choice rather than questioning yourself. It can be very uncomfortable for people who are used to getting more information. But in fact, our brains do better with less information in many circumstances.
Christine, we often assume that high-functioning people must have extraordinary willpower. And although I suppose that can't hurt, you've discovered that a better option for most of us is simply eliminating the need to waste our precious willpower on the little things.
Yeah, it's true that willpower can be very helpful, but very high-functioning people actually do a lot of things habitually. So our brain is really well set up to go on autopilot for many things. And our willpower is a really limited resource. You can grow your willpower over time, but that's a really tough strategy. A better strategy is to code your brain for the things that you want to have on autopilot, to learn how to get into a good habit. We know a lot about the neuroscience behind habits. There are some real tricks to getting into a good habit. And knowing that if you put things on autopilot, you free up a lot of that self-control, the focus, the willpower for the more creative tasks or the things that actually require that willpower. So an example is your morning routine. A lot of people spend a lot of time making little piddly decisions every single morning. Should I have coffee or then should I shower? What should I wear today? Should I pack my lunch or should I buy it? And all those little decisions, they might not feel like much, but they, by lunchtime, you may have exhausted your decision-making power.
Right.
So, I mean, that's not entirely true, but it does fatigue that system. So if you can learn to get into a morning routine, for example, in which you're not making any decisions, your alarm goes off. For me, I've programmed myself, right? So my alarm goes off and that triggers a cascade of events that I go, you know, to a meditation. I do a gratitude practice. I do this ridiculously unambitious exercise routine. But I do all of these things without any effort. I don't have to talk myself into doing push-ups. I just do them because my brain is programmed.
Sometimes I miss my Catholic school uniform that allowed me to never have to think about what I wore every day.
Yes, I know. Well, and there's really something to that. And we have these iconic figures in our society that wear the same thing all the time. And they're pretty high functioning, right? And so I suggest that unless getting dressed in the morning is a primary creative way for you to express yourself and you'll feel deprived, for most of us, it isn't that. And so give yourself permission to wear the same thing every day. I call it the laundry reduction program. And it's not that I'm necessarily wearing dirty clothes all the time. It's that I'm not making decisions about what I'm going to wear. So I have, you know, my favorite jeans. I just got a couple pairs of them and I wear them all the time. I wear the same type of shoe in different colors. When I have a speaking engagement, people are now, you know, tease me because I revealed in the sweet spot that I always wear this green dress from J. Crew that I actually have in blue and black as well. And so I walk on the scene and they're like, oh yeah, look at that. That's what you're wearing, right? Because I've already decided what I'm going to wear to my speaking engagements.
Christine Carter is with us. She's a sociologist and senior fellow at UC Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center. We're talking about her new book, The Sweet Spot, How to Find Your Groove at Home and Work. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Christine Carter. She's a sociologist and author of The Sweet Spot, How to Find Your Groove at Home and at Work. She's also a senior fellow at UC Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. I just want to take a moment, Christine, to ask you about the Greater Good Science Center, which is described as an interdisciplinary research center that translates the study of happiness, resilience, and emotional intelligence for the public. Is it like working at Disneyland without the measles? I mean, like, is every day like fully self-actualized and amazing?
Well, kind of. I mean, it is a pretty great place to work. You know, before every meeting, it's so Berkeley, I'm sure, for outside. We sit and we have a moment of, you know, meditation where we center ourselves, you know, and what it is a real practice of walking the talk, of embodying all of this incredible research about how our brains and our nervous systems will be the highest functioning. So I've been there for 12 years, and it has evolved over time. It's a much bigger center than it was when I was the executive director, and it, you know, it is a pretty wonderful place to work.
So how do you decide what to say yes to and what to turn down? And I guess we can start with, like, professional obligations and then sort of move into how you make that choice with personal obligations.
Well, you know, the important thing, I think, is to say no strategically and to be able to say yes with abandon. And those two things, you know, the saying no is kind of a head thing, the strategy, and the saying yes is more of a feeling state. So to kind of and it's really important to have a go-to way to say no. The people who have the hardest time saying no are really worried about other people and hurting their feelings, or about their job security and whether or not, you know, it's going to be disappointing to their boss or to their manager. And so it can take a little bit of courage. It also takes a little bit of strategy and just practice having a way to say no. So at work, I think one of the best ways to do it is the strategy to know where your time is best spent and where you can be the most productive, and not do things just simply because you think you should be doing them, or for prestige, or because it's the you know, it's going to get attention from certain people that might help you somewhere down the road. Those aren't necessarily the right reasons to be saying yes to something. And when we have a strategy behind it, so for me, I know I need to spend a certain amount of time every day as a writer in what I call think work, really focused, very quiet time. I actually block that time off on my calendar every day. And it's not that time, those time blocks aren't immovable. I can slide them around. But if somebody asks me to do something that conflicts with one of those times and I can't slide it around that day, then my go-to way to say no is to say, thank you so much for asking me. I might be able to do that at another time, but right now it's not going to work out for me. And to a clue there is to be vague about why you can't do something.
Yeah.
Because people are so helpful. They will jump in and offer to help you rearrange things or make it possible for you. So to just stand firm, take a deep breath, say it with confidence, and be grateful too, right? So a lot of times people are asking you to do something and they're extending themselves. And, you know, invitations are, even if we don't want to accept them, are oftentimes a place where somebody is becoming a little bit vulnerable. And that might be more at home than at work, but to acknowledge that it's not personal, you're not rejecting them. And one way to do that is to be grateful for the invitation.
What about those things that feel truly overwhelming, but that we really cannot get out of? A big project at work, or caring for an elderly parent, something that is going to fall to us whether we want it to, or you know, whether we would prefer to spend our time differently or not.
Yeah, life is full of difficult situations like that. And I think that a lot of the principles for doing good work apply in those situations as well. So if you're doing something that is a big task on your psyche, or, you know, it's just very difficult for you to acknowledge that, you know, even though you might feel like it should be easy for you, or you wish you weren't doing it, to not spend a lot of energy in guilt or resistance. If you have to do it and you can't minimize it or delegate it, or, you know, it is something that you absolutely have to do, to accept the difficulty of it for you, so that you're not, that resistance can take a lot of energy. And then have some compassion for yourself. You're doing a difficult thing. You're going to need to take a lot of breaks. Taking a break, that's a whole other topic, and it's a good thing to do, even if you are enjoying what you're doing. But it's particularly important for recharging in difficult situations. You know, what people do today instead of taking a break or accepting the difficulty of a situation is they kind of numb out the difficult emotions that might come up when they're doing something they don't really want to. So they spend a lot of time checking their email or checking their social media feeds, or, you know, we have a whole host of numbing behaviors in our society. There's lots of ways, you know, you can eat the entire pan of brownies, or you can have an extra glass of wine, or you can, you know, whatever your numbing tactic of choice is, to just be aware of it, right? Because here's the problem. When we numb out difficult feelings of maybe dread or just discomfort in a situation, we aren't really getting rid of them, right? Physiologically, our emotions have an effect on our bodies, our nervous system, and our brain. And when we engage in a numbing behavior, we are simply becoming less aware consciously of what is still there, and particularly from an emotional standpoint. And so a difficult emotion can be toxic in our bodies. It can be damaging, right? Anger, for example, we understand that it can hurt our bodies if it goes on too long. So that piece of it isn't very healthy, to just not process something. It lives in our body. But also, our numbing behaviors are not selective. We don't get to say, okay, I'm going to check my text messages compulsively, and that way I will not feel just the particular anxiety around this situation at work. It doesn't really work that way. We numb out the anxiety at work, but we also really numb out all the pleasant emotions, which have a positive physiological effect on our bodies, which make our brains work more efficiently and more effectively, that help us be more creative and connect with other people more. You know, so if we want to feel profound joy and gratitude or inspiration or any of the positive emotions, we also sometimes have to let ourselves feel uncomfortable or grief or sadness or whatever we're numbing.
It's so easy to fall into this like spiral of negativity when you feel overwhelmed. I love the mm-hmm. bit of advice to give what you call a micro moment of love, care, or warmth to someone else, maybe mm-hmm. unrelated to whatever it is you're dealing with at the moment.
Yeah, you know, our positive emotions are really powerful for us, and they're so much more accessible than we normally think. And when we, you know, a micro moment of connection or love can literally happen in a moment of eye contact or a quick little smile. So we think, oh, I'm so overwhelmed. I'm in a terrible mood. You know, the last thing I'm going to do is, you know, call a friend and or try and connect with somebody. Or it doesn't have to be that big, even though that's not that big. But, you know, we sometimes think it's out of our reach. And a simple little moment of making eye contact with the barista and smiling and asking her how she's doing can make a measurable impression on our nervous system for the better. So our positive emotions function to put the brakes on stress or the fight or flight response. Or, you know, typically they slow your heart rate down a little bit and deepen your breathing. And that creates feelings of well-being. And our positive emotions, when they're shared with other people, tend to be even more powerful. So we might think, I'm in a bad mood. I'm just going to run in and get a cup of coffee because I'm so tired, and I'm going to just get in and get out, and I'm not going to waste any time. But actually, it doesn't take more time to be friendly and to connect with all the people around us. And research shows that the other people benefit as well. So if you're chatting with the person in line in front of you, research shows that you'll leave happier and they'll leave happier too, even though both of you will predict that you wouldn't, right? Most people think, I don't want a stranger chatting with me. I don't talk to strangers, you know? That's creepy. People surprise themselves when researchers measure their overall level of, say, cheerfulness before a stranger, you know, just asks them how they're doing or makes eye contact and smiles. Those positive emotions go up.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Harvey in Nevada. Hi, Harvey.
How are y'all doing? What a great conversation.
Thank you.
Technical question here. How much of this is genetic? You know, I listen to the people talking about how you can be happy, And I look around, and I'm starting to believe more and more that about 90% of the reasons happy people are happy is because they're happy. And unhappy people are unhappy because they're genetically inclined to be unhappy. Do you find that in your...
No, not really. I mean, a rule of thumb is about half of our overall happiness level is genetic. But I like to think of happiness is much better thought of as a skill or a set of skills that we can learn and we need to practice. And so the people who are genetically prone to being more cheerful, for example, are better, the skills related to overall well-being or to happiness come to them more easily. So think of it like trying to learn a foreign language. Some people are going to pick up a new language really quickly. Other people are going to really struggle with it. And those differences are largely genetic and how hard they're trying. But no matter what, everybody still needs to be taught the basic grammar, the basic vocabulary. Everybody needs to practice a lot in order to become fluent. And here in the United States or in North America, we're really not necessarily learning the skills that we need to be happy. So we're not practicing to fluency in the way that we could.
We also tend to define, we assume that happiness means that every career and family and relationship dream has come true, every financial goal has been met, and then we can be happy. When in fact, if my understanding is correct, day to day, our level of happiness has a lot more to do with like little tiny things that happen for the better or the worse.
Yeah, you know, and the meaning that we bring to any given situation. So, you know, we conflate happiness with pleasure or gratification. And so we go after the thing. We think we're pursuing happiness or a richer sense of joy or positive emotions, but really we're pursuing pleasure. And that is very different in the brain and has a very different effect on us over the both in the short term and in the long term. So we think we're pursuing happiness. In fact, you know, we're going after something which may bring us actual real pleasure. You know, we might buy a new pair of shoes or have a really decadent meal, and those things might be gratifying, but they tend to trigger the reward system in our brain, which can be nice, but it functions to leave us wanting more. The neurochemicals, the chemical transmitters in our brain related to the reward system, they're designed to create desire and craving. And a sense of craving is not actually a very happy place to be.
When we have too much going on, for so many people, the first thing to go on the chopping block, if we're overscheduled, is exercise, which, of mm-hmm. course, we know is a bad idea for a lot of reasons. Mm-hmm. But tell us about the better-than-nothing exercise philosophy.
It's actually a philosophy to life, things that you know, that you know. So the philosophy is that the things that we do every day consistently turn out to have much more impact than the things that we just do every once in a while, even when the little small daily action is just seems really minor compared to a larger weekly kind of action. So I'll, with regards to exercise, I used to run marathons, and once even when I, during my period of time where I was sick, ran a half marathon with a fever, right? Like I was so convinced that it was really important for me to be running all the time and, you know, getting a lot of exercise. And what would happen is that I would get hurt, or I just wouldn't be able to find the 45 minutes I needed to go for a run. And so I invented the better than nothing exercise, which I was committed to do. I am committed still. I've been doing it for a couple of years, every single day, no matter what. It's one of these things that I put on autopilot. So basically, I do three exercises. It takes me 3 minutes. I started off by doing 10 push-ups and 25 or 30 sit-ups and 20 or 25 squats. And now I do 20 push-ups and a 1 minute plank and a 1 minute wall sit. And let me tell you, that might sound pathetically unambitious, but it is still hard for me. I'm barely increasing this. It takes less than 5 minutes. Really, it takes 3 minutes for me to do that whole thing. And if I try really hard, sometimes I'll even still be sore, right? So it is – and the other day somebody said, oh, my gosh, you have Michelle Obama arms, which to me was just such victory, right? Because I did this by doing push-ups every morning, you know, I may only be doing – now I'm doing 20, but, you know, so that's 140 push-ups a week. That's actually quite a lot, but it's 1 minute, you know, of push-ups. So it's something that you need to experience to really feel the benefits of it. But for people like me that tend to be overachieving, it's important to see where you can be more effective by scaling back.
Christine Carter is my guest. She's a sociologist and senior fellow at UC Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center. Her new book is called The Sweet Spot, How to Find Your Groove at Home and Work. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with sociologist Christine Carter of the Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley. She has a new book out called The Sweet Spot, How to Find Your Groove at Home and Work. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Lonnie, who wonders, Christine, if you would elaborate on the process of creating good habits.
Absolutely. And in fact, I have a free 21-day program to help people just learn in little tidbits. The first thing about this process is to take very small steps towards a new habit. The smaller, the tinier the habit you can make, the more likely it is that you'll stick. So that's why I've broken this program into 21 days. There's actually no real truth to our notion that it takes 21 days to establish a habit, but it is a nice chunk of time to think about working on a new habit. So the first piece of getting into a new habit is consistency. A lot of times people say, okay, well, I really want to exercise more or eat more kale or meditate or whatever it is that you'd like to get into the habit of. Thinking about a consistent time that you can do that every single day, because the way a habit works is that you have a trigger And so for my better than nothing exercise habit, for example, it's the original trigger was my alarm going off. Now it's finishing my meditation. So whatever happens right before you do the habit, that is what helps create the automaticity of it, so that your brain just sends you headlong into the next activity. You know, we have tons of little micro habits all the time. Lots of things can trigger a habit. It can be the time of day. It can be having low blood sugar. It can be an emotion. It could be, you know, feeling lonely can trigger a behavior like checking Facebook. So thinking about something that happens for you already every single day that you can use as a trigger, and then think about scaling back your habit into something that you could really commit to every single day. For starters, I'm not saying that you can't grow. It's not that I never exercise more. It's that coming up with that really teeny tiny habit is the way to start paving the road in your brain. Right. So you just want to start wiring the neurons together that you're going to need for your habit. And you start slowly.
And if we blow it for a day or two, it's important to know that we can recover from that. And it doesn't mean that this will never happen. So many times, what do you call it? The what the heck phenomenon or whatever, where we think, you know, I didn't do it today. So forget it. I'm just going to stop doing this thing.
I'm just going to eat the entire pie for breakfast, right?
Right.
Yeah, so the what the heck effect is a nicer way to put it. I think actually we have to change our orientation towards lapses, right? So they're a really important part of the process. So think about it as you're writing the code in your brain for a behavior. Once the code is perfect, it will run with no effort on your part, you know, and actually we know it will exist in your brain for the rest of your life. So it's worth getting it right. But every time we make a mistake or we have a lapse, think of that as an opportunity to debug the code. What obstacle did you not see beforehand? What created the resistance? Where was the temptation? What can you do differently to set yourself up for success tomorrow? So the first step is to just acknowledge that you've had a failure and forgive yourself for it. It's totally normal. 100% of people make mistakes while they're trying to get in a new habit. Nobody does this thing perfectly. And in fact, when I was trying to completely remodel all my habits for my morning routine, for example, it took me a very long time to get where I am now. But which isn't to say that I wasn't making any progress for a very long time. It was that I had dozens and dozens of lapses, which cued me to rearrange things a little bit. So another piece of getting into good habit is thinking about what the inherent reward in what you're doing is, and making it something that you look forward to rather than something that your unconscious mind is going to resist. So I thought, okay, well, I really want to listen to more TED Talks. And so when I do my exercise in the morning, I'm going to listen to a TED Talk. It didn't work for me, right? It wasn't sufficiently motivating. I have to, you know, it was the wrong length of time for starters. I needed little radio shorts that were a little bit more entertaining for me, that because it was really early in the morning and I wasn't thinking, right? And also, you know, it's funny, but I love to listen to books on tape. And even though I know I'm only going to get to listen for 5 minutes while I exercise and then make my bed, I'm very motivated. I love listening to David Sedaris, for example. I just think it's funny. And so those are the types of things that I had to learn. What is a good enough reward? You know, what does seem to be a stumbling block? Do you falter every time it rains? Do you have looking for patterns? Those are important clues to where the bugs in your system are.
It's funny that you say that, because putting a radio in my bathroom makes me much happier to clean my bathroom, even if I know it's going to take like 45 minutes.
Totally. Yeah. I know. I trick myself every night. Part of my bedtime routine is, you know, I let myself listen to a book on whatever I'm listening to, and I clean up the house. I put things away. I'm sort of sloppy and that I would just leave my clothes in a pile on the bathroom floor. But I pick it all up if I'm listening to a book because that's entertaining to me.
Okay, so it's one thing, you mentioned meditation, which is great for helping us to be present within our own minds at any particular moment. Sometimes when we've got a million things going on, it becomes challenging to be present for the people in our lives who we really care about and want to be present for. What do we do?
Well, I'll tell you what doesn't work. It doesn't necessarily work to just try and will yourself constantly to be more present. That kind of resistance to what is actually happening, at least for me, it didn't work at all. What I know does work is to limit the things in your life, to be really strategic about the things in your life that are making it hard for you to be present. So most people have a hard time being present at home or now even at work in meetings and things if they if their smartphone is anywhere in the vicinity, right? It's very tempting. You know, I watch people at red lights today, and I can remember a time in my life in which I was so uncomfortable with just stillness that I was checking my phone at red lights, just even that 1 minute. So it's developing this as a skill, a willingness to just stare into space, to be still, to let there be space for something to emerge, is really important. You know, we assume, this goes back to the busyness thing, you know, we assume that staring into space, for example, is just a total waste of time, and time is money, and we don't want to waste money either, and these things are bad, right? But that's and the basic underlying assumption is that our brain is just off during that time and we should be putting it to work. But it's not. We know beyond a shadow of a doubt that that is not true at all. When you're just staring into space, you know, not focused on anything, your brain goes into a default mode in which there's a neural network that becomes very active, and that network draws connection between things that you previously did not consciously see as related. And all those neural connections that are being made lead to insight and creativity. So if we want to be working and living from our sweet spot where we have our greatest power, we need the insights that our brain tends to pull together rather unconsciously for us. If we block that from happening. So that doesn't totally answer your question about being present with the people in our lives that we love, but it's a part of it. Part of the reason that we aren't totally present is because our attention is so called all the time to check our emails, to check the dinging, the messages and everything. So being really strategic about our phones and our computers, no, not having them in the dining room, they're like a bowl of candy, of Halloween candy. Mm-hmm. This is the way I think about it in my own life. If I had a bowl of Halloween candy on my car dashboard and in my bathroom and at my bedside table that I had to like dig through it to turn my alarm off in the morning and then it was, you know, at breakfast with me, I would sure be eating a lot of candy.
Right.
Because we have a limited ability to resist that kind of temptation. But if you just put the candy away and have a piece after lunch strategically and maybe a piece after dinner or whatever, whenever you decide to check it. It's not that the technology is bad. It's that the constant demand on our attention has a pretty profound effect on our overall intelligence, our relationships with other people, our ability to innovate, to think clearly, to plan. You know, I could go on and on.
Let's go quickly to the phone here. We have Tom on the line in Arlington. Hey, Tom.
How you doing?
Great, thanks.
I had a comment from the conversation you all were having earlier about happiness. I had an experience when I was much younger where I was drafted, and I was pretty unhappy about the situation. The people I was around that I enjoyed being with were fairly happy, and I finally stopped to realize that, wait a minute, these guys are in the same situation I am. Mm-hmm. They're happy. And I'm not. What's the difference? And I came to the conclusion that happiness is largely an arbitrary decision, that they just chose to be happy with what they have, and they were.
What do you think, Christine?
You know, That is such a wonderful experience for somebody to have. I hope that all of my children have that experience one day, because what you brought an acceptance to a situation, a difficult situation, that then allowed you to see it differently. And, you know, it's not that it's we can just will ourselves to be happy by saying, I choose happiness. It's that our brains are giant filters, and they look for patterns in our world, and they filter out things that don't seem to fit the pattern. So if we're in a situation that we're resisting and that we don't want to be in it, the pattern that we're telling our brain is relevant is, you know, we're basically saying to our brain, look for everything about this situation that's terrible, that that doesn't fit with what you want for your life. And when we start to look for the positive patterns, the things that are good, that you can learn about the challenging situation. I mean, maybe the only thing you're learning is how to deal with difficulty better. That's going to be useful later in life, right? So we can, in almost any situation, if we have to be in it and we accept that, we can open up the possibility that there could be some good that is coming from that difficulty. And that pattern changes the input that comes into our bodies and our brain and the way that we see the world.
Is there peer pressure for successful adults to be busy all the time? And what do you do about that friend you have who's, you know, running her own law firm and hand making, you know, her husband's shirts and, you know, running the church fundraiser and sort of leaves you in the dust?
Totally. Sending her children to school with homemade organic lunches.
Right, right.
Yeah. Yes. There is a lot of peer pressure. You know, it seems like the most impressive people in our society are the busiest. And it comes up constantly when people ask us how we are doing, right? So our cultural mantra is, you know, how are you? I'm busy. That's the answer. The answer is some form of I'm very busy and important.
Right.
And so my best suggestion is to muster the courage it takes to be divergent in this arena, to know that this is directly related to what we were just talking about with the last caller, in that if you are looking for a pattern of busyness, basically you're creating a sense of overwhelm. And that overwhelm in your own life is limiting you. And so when somebody tells me that they are busy or overwhelmed, or just that they never slow down for anything, what I think to myself is, you are not fulfilling your potential. And I have to do it even more so for myself all the time. People say, oh, how are you? I mean, this last week has been particularly like that, because I've launched a book and people say, oh my gosh, you must be so busy with this book launch. And I have to stop myself from looking at all the ways that I've been busy and think, I explain to them, actually, here's all the things that are going well in my life, that all the reasons I'm not overwhelmed, that because I know that I can fulfill my potential best by looking at those things instead.
Sociologist Christine Carter's new book is The Sweet Spot: How to Find Your Groove at Home and Work. Christine, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. This was really fun.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.